welcome to Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, glad you are with us. We have a lot to get to today, and coming up in just a bit, we'll mark the 90th anniversary of the Natural Resources Conservation Service, born out of the Dust Bowl to protect America's farmland. But with deep budget cuts and losses, the agency now faces a storm of its own. That story, plus historian Tom Ezern uncovers the legacy of the Baldwin Ranches, and we go mushroom hunting in natural North Dakota. Plus, we'll hear a love story from the tell that proves timing is everything. And we begin Main Street today with a conversation with Yasmina Shimchek. She's a senior at St. Mary's Central High School in Bismarck, and she's headed to Villanova University this fall. Well, she's also a parishioner at Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck, and we thought it would be great to have a conversation with her about what a new American Pope means to her and younger North Dakota Catholics. Yasmina, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
How did you feel when you first heard that an American was selected as Pope?
Well, to be fairly honest, I was really surprised. I know a lot of people never considered him as one of their top candidates. And I think that, yeah, it's really great. I was really excited about it. I think it's a super cool fact that he's from the U.S. And I think that it's going to bring a lot of people to the faith, especially people that are living in the United States.
And especially young people, do you think? He is perceived by me, and I'm not Catholic, Yasmina, but he's perceived to me to be a younger Pope and maybe a little more energetic. Do you think that that will impact the way young American Catholics view their faith?
Definitely. And I think his connection to Chicago and the White Sox, I think that also kind of connects with the younger generation.
What do you perceive the role of the Pope in either your life or in the life of the church?
Well, for the church, he's the Bishop of Rome, and he kind of is in charge of all of the things that go on within our church community. He's in charge of making important rules, I guess, and it kind of depends on what's going on in the world at the time, and I think that this will be a very interesting time for Pope Leo to be Pope. I think that it's a very transitional time in terms of young Catholics. And so I think that, yeah, he's just going to have a lot of important things to decide upon. Whatever the popes speak on are obviously very important to consider. And I think that we have to be a lot more mindful of what's going on in our world and sort of how to approach those things.
Tell me about how you perceive Pope Francis. Growing up, what was your thought of him, and then what did you feel when he passed away?
Yeah, I think Pope Francis was a great guy. I honestly didn't really think about it too much until I went to Rome last summer for a pilgrimage through my school, and I actually got to have Mass with him on the feast day of St. Peter and Paul, so it was super cool to see him in person. And yeah, it was very sad when he passed, and it was really interesting to follow the events of the conclave and obviously to see our new pope elected.
Did you watch the movie Conclave prior, and were you thinking about that during this process?
I did not watch the movie, but I had learned about kind of what happens and what takes place in a conclave in school. So I was very interested in the process, and I think that it's super cool.
Yasmina, do you think that having an American pope makes the Catholic Church more connected to you personally? In one way or another?
I think so. I think that because he's from the U.S. and Chicago specifically, I think I'm a lot more invested. I used to live in Rockford, Illinois, so it's sort of close to Chicago, which is a fun fact. And also he graduated from Villanova and I'm going to Villanova, so I think that that's a super cool connection. And I think that that's something that I'll keep in mind going forward with my faith.
What qualities are important to you personally?
I think that just hope is something super important. I think that as a generation, we need to have a lot more hope in the future and in our faith. And so I think that that's something that Pope Leo will bring.
In watching the coverage, I saw many younger people, but perhaps not high school or middle school age students. Do you think that Catholic students your age across the country were paying attention with the vigor perhaps that you were?
Apparently, I've seen all over the internet lots of students watching the live stream of when Pope Leo came out. I know personally I was in the lunchroom and we had the live stream going on a TV and all of our computers, and we were all cheering as he came out. So I think that everyone was definitely following it very closely.
Do you believe that an American pope will influence the church's teachings or priorities? And if so, what's on your mind?
I don't know in what way maybe the church would be influenced, but I do think that more people would be influenced in the United States specifically. I think people from the United States are obviously very proud of him and that they have that connection. And I think it's just a great sense of pride that we have someone from our country up there kind of running the big show.
Perhaps a tough question here, Yasmina. Are there any issues or challenges in the church that you hope an American pope will address?
I think that there are just a lot of people who don't believe, I guess. And I think that maybe this will help to bring a lot more people to the faith.
How do you think an American pope will change how the rest of the world views the United States? Have you given that thought?
To be honest, I haven't thought about this one very much, but I hope that it allows people to view the United States in a good light. And I think that he'll be a good representative of who we are as American Catholics.
What have you thought about the American media coverage so far relative to the election of an American pope?
I think that it's been very informational. I think that we're learning a lot, especially like for people who are getting interviewed about this, like Pope Leo's brothers and stuff. I think that we're learning a lot about him and how he grew up, and also like people's perceptions of him. I think that everyone seems very excited.
Generally speaking, do you think religion and Catholicism in particular is as important to young North Dakotans like yourself as perhaps 10 years ago, or maybe less important today? And what do you think about that?
I have to say I haven't lived in North Dakota for very long. I moved here almost 3 years ago, so I'm not exactly sure. But I would say, just from being on the Rome pilgrimage with a bunch of people throughout North Dakota, I think that our faith is very strong, and I think that there's a good community of us who are very strong in our faith, and we really appreciate our faith.
If you could ask the new pope one question, Yasmina, what might that be?
Oh, no, I feel like maybe I would ask him, just what is it like to know that there are so many people who are kind of depending on you and are putting their faith in the fact that you now carry so much responsibility? Like, just what does that feel like?
My guest is Yasmina Shimchek. She's a senior at St. Mary's Central High School in Bismarck, and she's headed to Villanova University this fall. She's a parishioner also at the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck. She's also the editor of her school's newspaper. And let's turn the page, Yasmina, if we could, just a little bit. I'm curious about what other topics might be on your classmates' mind, and specifically, have you thought about something like the new bell-to-bell cell phone ban that your younger students in the high school are going to have to experience next year?
I have heard about the cell phone, yeah. So I think that obviously a lot of kids are really connected to their phones and they're not very willing to give them up. But I do think it could be beneficial. Last summer when I did go on that Rome pilgrimage, we did not have our phones for those 2 weeks. We had to leave them at home. And it really brought us all together, and we were all very close by the end of this trip. And I think that there's a certain beauty in kind of putting away our cell phones and being able to have that human connection that we're all searching for through our phones, but we aren't exactly finding. And so I do know that it's a very controversial topic among young people, and not a lot of people are appreciating it, but I do think that there is some benefit to it.
Beyond the cell phone ban, are there other recent policies or events in North Dakota that students at your school are chatting about, or perhaps that you're covering in the newspaper?
Not particularly. We mostly cover like local events, like whatever sports are going on and certain achievements that our students have.
Are students at your school becoming more or less engaged, would you say, with state and local issues? And what do you think is driving that trend either way?
I would say that there are some kids that are getting more and more involved, especially those involved in student government and things like, just the student government and different clubs and stuff like that, student congress. I think that those students are definitely becoming more involved, but there are definitely a few people that are trending away from that. And I think that it's just maybe a lack of relevance to them. They don't feel as though they're connected to the things happening.
If I were to ask you where most of your classmates get their news from, what would you tell me?
Probably just whatever happens to be on their social media pages. I don't think people would very often go to like a news website or anything.
You told me off mic you plan to be an English major. Where do you see yourself upon graduation when you graduate from Villanova?
I'd love to get into the publishing industry. I think it's super cool, and I don't think a lot of people appreciate books anymore or the power of literature. So I think that that's something I'd be super interested in doing. I also love book to movie adaptations, and I think that that would also be something super cool to explore.
My guest today on Main Street has been Yasmina Simcheck. She's a senior at St. Mary's Central High School in Bismarck, and she's headed to Villanova University, the same school as the new American Pope, Pope Leo, attended. She's also editor-in-chief of her school newspaper and a parishioner at Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck. It's been a pleasure.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Martin Media, bringing Paula Poundstone, comic and regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to the Fargo Theater on Friday, May 30th. Tickets and information at paulapoundstone.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The black blizzards of the Dust Bowl blanketed homes, buried tractors, and drove families to desperation, but they also sparked a conservation movement that changed American agriculture forever. This spring marks the 90th anniversary of the Natural Resources Conservation Service, born from crisis to protect the land that feeds us. But as we reflect on that legacy, the NRCS now faces sweeping job losses, deep budget cuts, and an uncertain future. In this report from Harvest Public Media, we take a look at how one of the country's most trusted conservation agencies is weathering its latest storm.
A series of fierce dust storms billowed through the Great Plains during the Great Depression of the 1930s. A combination of poor land management practices and prolonged drought combined to create the Dust Bowl. It's described here in this Depression-era government film.
The big dust storms came only once or twice a year, but even more destructive were the steady, sweeping winds, lasting many months each year and keeping the dry, powdery soil restless and unproductive.
During the drought's harshest period, an estimated billion tons of soil were lost across the Great Plains. Some of it even darkened the skies over East Coast cities. One of the worst storms that came to be called Black Sunday caught the attention of Congress in April 1935. Within weeks, lawmakers created the Soil Conservation Service.
It was not hard to get people on board with these conservation practices because they were desperate.
That's Pamela Riney Kurdberg, a history professor at Iowa State University.
They were going to lose their farms if they didn't find an alternate form of income. And if you are desperate not to lose your farm, you are going to cooperate.
The government paid farmers to leave their land fallow, to put in ponds, and to terrace their land. 90 years later, more advanced efforts continue under what's now called the Natural Resources Conservation Service. NRCS works with producers and landowners to improve soil health and prevent erosion through practices like no-till farming and cover crops. Kevin Norton is a former associate chief of the NRCS. Over his 40-year career, he says the demand for conservation assistance from farmers and ranchers remained strong.
And it's worked. I mean, we have a lot cleaner air. We have less dust in the air. We have an abundant food supply and less erosion. So I think we've got a wonderful system. It's been successful. I think it can be improved. It always has been because times change. You know, things need to change.
There's been rapid change at the agency over the last several months. Since President Trump took office, the NRCS has lost as much as 20% of its workforce. Estimated numbers, which the USDA would not confirm, find about 2,400 employees retired or took a buyout or were laid off. Carrie Klebanowski, an NRCS public affairs specialist in Oklahoma, says she loved her job, but decided to leave to avoid more uncertainty.
But I'm sad and I'm worried for what the future holds for the people that I worked with that I know care so much about the farmers and our soils and the conservation work that they're doing, and just not knowing what that's going to look like.
President Trump is proposing $770 million in cuts to NRCS next fiscal year, as well as consolidating the agency's county offices. Kaylee Olson, policy manager at the Center of Rural Affairs in Lyons, Nebraska, says the strength of NRCS has always been its local ties with farmers and ranchers. With fewer employees, she says farmers may have to wait longer.
Let's just say we have a producer who's interested in trying cover crops for the first time. If there's a longer wait list, so to speak, of getting support from NRCS, that producer might just opt to forego cover crops.
Olson says NRCS workers are resilient. She expects they'll figure out how to do the work that's needed. Some familiar with the agency, which sprung out of the Dust Bowl, say it will weather the current political climate and help farmers for another 90 years. I'm Anna Pope, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the archives of North Dakota State University, 32 feet of dusty records tell the sweeping story of the Baldwin Ranches in Dickey County, once sprawling across 70,000 acres. Historian Dr. Tom Ezern unpacks how these early 20th century farms blended innovation, sustainability, and grit on the Northern Plains in this Plains Folk essay.
Pushing boxes and pulling folders from the massive Baldwin Corporation records held for the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU Archives, I come to the realization we have a lot to learn about life on the plains by rereading the considerable, I should say massive, documentation available in the reading room. Given that the papers of the Baldwin Farms in Dickens County alone comprise 32 feet of records, it's a heck of a job. What is to be gained by such work? Not just business transactions, but an unparalleled view of people on the land, interacting effectively with soils and crops and livestock. Possibly some lessons about possibilities of living with the land on the Northern Plains. A handy introduction to the larger story is the master's thesis in agricultural economics done at North Dakota Agricultural College in 1924 by Orville M. Fuller. Fuller was assistant farm manager for Baldwin Farms, headquartered in Ellendale. Its holdings, which once comprised 70,000 acres or more, still sprawled across the county. An investor from Wisconsin, George B. Baldwin Sr., accumulated the Baldwin holdings in the 1880s and 1890s. In his late years, they were neglected, run down, weed-infested. When he died in 1907, his sons, George Jr. and Charles, took over. They reorganized, consolidated, sold, but kept a lot of land, including a string of model farms stretching northeast from Ellendale, which they chose to call, perhaps embracing a bit of Western romance, ranches. Young Orville Fuller was in the middle of all this. His thesis shows that although his major was ag econ, his love was the agronomy of farm management on the ground. In the system of four ranches, averaging 1,440 acres each, he managed with his local boss, J.W. McNary, he implemented ingenious, sustainable systems of operation, and the details matter. Every headquarters had a ranch manager's residence and a suite of buildings, mainly for livestock, comprising fine cattle, Angus and Shorthorn, hogs, sheep, and horses. Horses because although the Baldwin operations tried tractor farming, they found horses and big hitches suited their operations and contributed to their manure supply, which was important. Livestock wintered at the headquarters sites, bedded with straw from the fall's threshing, accumulated many tons of manure, all of which was spread on the fields within a half a mile of the headquarters. These nearby fields carried a rotation of corn, which sometimes made grain, other times was chopped for silage, oats needed for the horses. Raising corn on fall-plowed ground and cultivating it four times eliminated weeds. Sometimes, instead of shucking the corn, they hogged it down, turning pigs into the fields to do the work and deposit manure. Winter wheat, yes, winter wheat, in 1924, fall sown in rye stubble for winter production, was raised on the other lands, or sometimes barley with a legume, alfalfa, or more commonly sweet clover, in the rotation. Sweet clover, says Fuller, tends to liven up the soil and add organic matter, as well as furnishing pasture. Sheep were pastured on the wheat stubble, again distributing manure. Resident farmhands, employed all year in the diversified operations, slept at the headquarters and were fed by the manager's wife. Some of the Shorthorn cattle were milkers. All in all, this was not your stereotypical bonanza farm. There is so much to be learned from the voluminous Bonanza Farm records, little used since the 1960s. You young scholars, pitch in.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and shares his Plainsfolk essays with our Prairie Public listeners. Coming after the break, another story from The Tell about how friendship, timing, and fate led to love. And Chuck Lura, in his Natural North Dakota essay, tells us what to look for during this magical time of year when we're foraging for mushrooms. That's ahead. Stay with us. Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal asked a big question in When Harry Met Sally. Can female and male friends remain platonic? But the bigger and better thing the movie asked was, could your soulmate also be your best friend? Well, you probably know the ending, and spoiler alert if you don't, the two pals realized the depth of their love and lived, we presume, happily ever after. Tahira Bolton, today's storyteller from The Tell, downtown Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, traces love's continuous route to when the stars finally aligned for her and the person she was destined to finally be with. And just in time.
It had to be you. It had to be you.
Okay, back in 1980, my family moved into a wonderful neighborhood, the Hawthorne neighborhood, and it was the best neighborhood on earth to grow up in. And we were all so tight-knit in that community, and it was amazing to grow up there. And in 1987, there happened to be a night in high school when we all went out to a punk rock show over here at the Civic Center. And after that show, there was a house party because somebody a block away happened to have parents out of town. And she still hears about that party from her parents today. And that was 1987. So as normally happens at house parties back in the day, everybody coupled off and paired up. And all of a sudden, there's this one guy and I who grew up in the same neighborhood saying, oh, hi. We went and climbed out on the roof and sat there and talked until the sun came up. And it was beautiful. And we had so much fun. And then we'll jump forward about 6 years, because I don't think we talked again for 6 years. Bumped into each other after we had both moved away at Ralph's. My home away from home all through my college years at MSUM, at that time Morehead State. We had the best evening in the back room at Ralph's, just sitting there catching up and just wonderful. And we sat there and talked for like 3-4 hours, and it was, you know, just drink after drink and talking and talking. And end of the night, he says to me, "You remember that night on Sarah's roof? You know, I really wanted to kiss you that night." And I was just speechless. And we kept talking. And we sat there in that bar until bar closed and went our separate ways. And a few months later, he got married to someone else. And, you know, life happens. And I couldn't handle that he had just married someone else, so I left the state. And I went and lived in Bozeman, Montana for a while, in South Florida for a while. And I'm trying really hard to consolidate this because the story would be so much better if I had 20 minutes. And I ended up settling down for about 20-some years in the mountains of New Mexico, and that was the best place I spent a lot of my life. I ended up connecting with someone there. You know, he got married and had a daughter, and, you know, life was happening. The man that I was with decided he didn't want to have kids. I knew this when we got together, but he was very clear that kids were not on his list and getting married was not on his list, and that was okay. I was just in it for the fun at the time, and we were in our 20s, and, you know, life was good. We were riding motorcycles in the mountains, and then I came home one year. This would have been 2002. So we're going to jump ahead a bit, but 2002, I came home when I lost my grandpa, and my best girlfriend that I grew up next door to, who happens to be the bartender tonight, Janelle, she had a brand new baby who was just 2 weeks old, and I held that baby, and oh, it was amazing, and she and my mother both looked at me and said, "Oh, you look good with one of those." I went home and told the man that I'd spent the last 5 or so years with, "You know, I know you told me you didn't want kids, but I just realized I really do. And that's something I really need in my life." And he said, "Great, go do that." And I ended up coming home then 3 weeks later to Fargo, Moorhead to spend Christmas with this guy that had married someone else back in the day, and we'd always stayed in touch. We saw each other every time I came to town. We were always close. I introduced him to this man I had been living with as my soulmate. I mean, literally, I brought this guy home to meet my family, and I said, "Oh, and you gotta meet this other guy who's like, if only the universe had let the timing be right, this is who I would be with," but it didn't let that happen, so, you know. I then came home then that Christmas to spend time with him because all of a sudden I'm free and he's free, and he tells me, "You know, I can't do this. I just can't do this." And okay. So that didn't happen. And it was heartbreaking. And we both went on with life. He had 3 wives. I stuck to the one husband. But we both had kids and lives and were happy. And last year, it just so happened that both of our long-term marriages ended, and I moved home. And one of the reasons I moved home was because my daughter chose NDSU. I mean, we weren't living locally, and the fact that she chose that made me so happy. But I came home, and we said, "Hey, should we give this a shot?" And it was magical. It was absolutely amazing. Within 2 weeks, it was like we were an old married couple that had been together for 40 years because we were that comfortable together, and we'd always longed for that. And it was the most beautiful, beautiful thing to finally come back together after waiting literally 32 years we waited to be together. And it was amazing. And when I got back and got together with him, he was in stage 4 kidney failure. And he was struggling, and it was a tough time, and he passed away in January of this year, but I was so blessed to finally get that time with him. And I know the light is red, but I'm going to tell one more little bit of what made that last year with him so inconceivable. Everything in the universe made it feel like we were always meant to be together. My daughter, who was here going to NDSU, She bought concert tickets for us to go to a show in Minneapolis. And when he heard about this concert, he said, "Oh my gosh, I have to go. I've got to go to that with you. That's one of the bands on my bucket list." We went to XL Energy Center in St. Paul. And if any of you know that place, it's freaking huge. He bought the seat next to us. I mean, everything about this felt so meant to be. It was 8 months after my daughter bought the tickets that he got the seat next to us. And there were so many things about the last year that made that entire wait so worth it. And that's my story.
That was Tahira Bolton's love story from The Tell, a monthly live storytelling event in the tradition of The Moth. The next Tell show is Thursday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the 4 and 4, which is above the Side Street Grill in downtown Fargo. More information on The Tell's Facebook and Instagram social media pages.
Putting this weed on your plate could protect the ocean. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's time to move from words to action. That's what the new Pope, Leo XIV, said at a Vatican climate conference in 2024.
He also warned that humanity has a tyrannical dominion over nature and urged what he termed a return to a relationship of reciprocity with creation.
Robert Francis Prevost, as Pope Leo was known, has said that the environmental challenge facing the world must be based on the social doctrine of the Church. He reiterated the Vatican's commitment to protect the planet, as shown by its installation of solar panels and a shift to electric vehicles.
Leo carries on the views expressed by his predecessor, Francis, who in 2015 issued an encyclical saying that the Earth is our common home and is like a sister or a mother on whom we've inflicted harm because of the use and abuse of her goods. He mourned consumerism and irresponsible economic development.
Leo has also warned against the harmful consequences of unchecked technological advancement. The new Pope, the first American to be chosen, grew up on the south side of Chicago and spent about 20 years in Peru, where he is a naturalized citizen.
Before becoming Pope, he said on social media that U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance was wrong to say the Christian doctrine tells us to rank our love for others, starting with the family and putting people from other countries last.
While Leo has been outspoken on climate and the environment, he has attracted some criticism from LGBTQ+ Catholics for a remarks he made about 10 years ago, condemning what he said was the homosexual lifestyle and gay marriage.
According to the late academic Emmanuel Wallerstein, it's important for non-Catholics to be concerned about the papal selection because the Vatican is a major geopolitical actor and the head of the Church is just like other world leaders. We need omega-3 fatty acids in our diets to be healthy, but the human body can't really produce these lipids, so we have to get them from our food. Currently, people in 85% of the world's countries don't get enough omega-3, and according to a new study, they're about to get less.
That's because the main source for omega-3 is seafood, but there's a growing shortage because of climate change, overfishing, and pollution. That is not just a public health problem, it's a planetary one, says Timothy Shishelsky, a research scientist at Case Western Reserve University.
In a conversation with H2O Radio, he said the problem begins with algae, which are the powerhouses of omega-3 production. If you were willing to eat enough kelp or seagrass, you could possibly get your needs met, but most of us would probably prefer a nice salmon fillet.
Unfortunately, warming ocean waters are reducing how much omega-3 that algae can produce. Since they're at the bottom of the food chain, that means less omega-3 is taken up by small fish, which are then eaten by bigger fish, who have less of the lipids to offer us on our dinner plates.
Making matters worse, many fish contain contaminants like methylmercury, PFAS compounds, and plastics, which might make you turn to supplements that contain omega-3 extracted from fish oil and then purified. However, Shashelsky said if there's a shrinking amount of omega-3 in fish, then companies will need to acquire more fish to get the same concentrations, which will compound the problem of overfishing. Also, it's not practical to think that most people worldwide can access pills.
There are other sources of omega-3 called ALA, derived from plants, versus the EPA and DHA found in fatty cold water fish like salmon, mackerel, and sardines. However, plant sources tend to have a different fatty acid called omega-6.
While omega-3 helps reduce inflammation in the body, omega-6 increases it. For most of human history, we've had balanced diets, so eating both fats wasn't a problem. But today's Western fare contains about 20 times more omega-6 than omega-3, mostly from vegetable oils, and Shashelsky says that leads to a host of health problems.
To be clear, omega-6 lipids are beneficial, and we don't need to reduce the amount in our food. Instead, we need to add more omega-3 to have them in proportion to reduce conditions tied to chronic inflammation like heart disease, cancer, preterm birth, and some mental health issues.
So what to do? Clearly, addressing climate change, overfishing, and pollution would be ideal to keep ocean food webs intact, but action has been slow. One bright spot is a plant called purslane, which most people might recognize as a weed growing in cracks in sidewalks or in lawns.
It's a rare case where a plant contains both EPA and DHA, but from a terrestrial source. Putting more of it on the menu could offset concerns about sourcing omega-3 from the ocean.
Shashelsky says you should make sure to eat purslane in moderation and from a source free of herbicides to get the full benefit, but the plant could help us to protect ocean health and our own health at the same time.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Buffalo are a key species for the environment and indigenous communities. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke with Don Sherman, the executive director of the Tonka Fund and a member of the Lakota, Shawnee, and Delaware tribes about the importance of returning buffalo to indigenous land.
The return of buffalo to ancestral lands is a powerful moment for many indigenous nations. Can you talk about the work that Tonka Fund does, and what does buffalo mean to the Tonka Fund and how their return impacts cultural revitalization efforts?
Our mission at Tonka Fund is to return buffalo to the lands, lives, and economies of indigenous peoples. So Tonka Fund was born out of Kyle, South Dakota, which is on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And because the buffalo was part of who we are, it's our ancestor, it's our relative, we saw the need for our ranchers that they just didn't have access. You know, we're in a huge 2.9 million square acres, and there's cattle all around us. Like, we're in a protein factory, but there's no buffalo. You know, none of our relatives are, you know, there are very few of our relatives on that land. So we saw that, and they didn't have access to get that buffalo into the market too, right? If they wanted to feed their people, it leaves the reservation and it may never come back, that meat, right? So we saw that our ranchers did need support, and that buffalo deserved to be on this land because they are the keystone species. And by returning the buffalo, you revitalize the culture, right? So bringing that back brings all of that connection back that we had with the buffalo, and that's our role there. Is we're stewards to the buffalo, who are the voiceless, and giving them the voice, and we're stewards to those ranchers to try to assist them bringing those buffalo back to the lands and to the different cultures, because we represent probably 10 tribes right now in Tonka Fund, and we'll be adding more all the time throughout the year.
What are some of the biggest challenges faced in, you know, making these buffalo restoration efforts a reality, and also what are some of the biggest successes that you've seen this far?
So it's the access to land, the access to the capital, and then the opportunities that we're not given to us that were given to the rest of the country while we were sitting without those opportunities. And then the great things, I would say, watching those buffalo run on the land for the first time in 200 years. One of our ranchers, she's up in Cheyenne River, got buffalo this year, and she got some yearlings, and it was the first time they've touched her family's land in 200 years that buffalo's ever touched that grass. So to see that, it still gives me goosebumps. We've been in this for 12 years, and I have been, and just to watch those buffalo and to see the smile on our people's faces and to know that that's where they belong, that's where our relatives belong, is on this land.
That's awesome. And that kind of leads into my next question that I had is, you know, buffalo play a crucial role in maintaining healthy ecosystems, and how does their introduction contribute to land restoration and biodiversity in, you know, the regions that they're being released in?
They were built for this land, and we've all heard their hooves aerate the land. It helps penetrate the soil to help aerate it, but also it gets them down into that seed bank, which most people don't understand, within, you know, the grass prairies and stuff. And, you know, 6 to 8 feet down, there's a seed bank of historical seed. And as they're walking, right, it's distributing and it feeds the birds. You know, they have a symbiotic nature to many animals, such as the black-footed ferret and the magpie. And so without the buffalo, those animals pretty much almost went extinct. When the buffalo went away, the ferrets were, you know, and they're just now getting reintroduced again over these last many years. So it's really that symbiotic nature. They graze based on the seasons and their diets, so they don't overgraze and down to the root. The wallowing creates water holes for amphibians and bugs and other animals to come and eat. So as they're moving through the grasslands, you can actually see the changes that happen over many years of, you know, the return of natural prairies, natural grasses, and different types of animals.
And lastly, what does the future look like for buffalo restoration, and how has, you know, climate change impacted these efforts that the Tonga Fund does?
Buffalo are pretty resilient, just like our people. We're very resilient, so they are adjusting to these extreme changes as far as the cold, the floods, and, you know, the heat and things such as that. The main thing is just giving them enough space and healthy food and water. So I would say the future looks really bright. The collaborations between groups, DC, government, NGOs, nonprofits such as ourselves are all really collaborating to make sure that we keep these animals on the land, because we see how needed they are, because they're our relatives, right, and our ancestors, and they deserve the same opportunity we had.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. It's that magical time of year when seasoned foragers and curious newcomers head into the woods, eyes peeled for the elusive morel mushroom, nature's edible sponge on a stick. But while the thrill of the hunt is part of the fun, knowing your morels from their mischievous lookalikes could make all the difference between a delicious meal and a risky mistake, as Chuck Lura tells us in this natural North Dakota.
If the morel mushrooms are not popping up in your area now, they should be soon. As many of you know, morel mushrooms are eminently edible and the mushrooms of choice for mushroom hunters. Morel mushrooms resemble a sponge on a stem, but more about that later. They're mushrooms of spring. Many morel enthusiasts will search diligently for them when the lilacs are in bloom or when the oak leaves are the size of mouse ears. The first rule of eating wild mushrooms is don't eat any mushroom you can't positively identify. Okay, so there's the disclaimer. And please be aware of a group of morel lookalikes called false morels. Their edibility is often listed as edibility unknown. And although they are actually quite easy to differentiate from true morels, they are occasionally misidentified. The morels I have seen in the state are generally between 3 and 5 inches tall, with a tan or dark brown cap. The key characteristic of morels is that the cap has distinctive ridges and pits. As such, they're often described as a sponge on a stick. Another important characteristic is that the cap is attached to the stalk at the base of the cap. False morels, on the other hand, have a cap with folds and convolutions, more like a brain or a walnut. And the cap is draped over the stalk, which extends up into the cap, where it's attached at the very top. The cap of a false morel is often described as resembling a skirt with many folds that hang over the stalk. So where should one look for morels? That's not easily answered, in part because the ecology of morels is not well understood. Plus, if you ask a morel hunter where to find a patch of morels, take the answer with a large grain of salt. Like a favored fishing hole, morel patches are heavily guarded secrets. However, morels have been associated with oak, elm, ash, willow, aspen, and cottonwood trees, as well as old apple orchards. The only factor that I have found to give a high probability of finding morels are to spend less time walking and more time looking. Places where I've previously found them, and areas that have been recently burned or disturbed in other ways. If you're fortunate to find the mother lode of morels, have at it. Collecting mushrooms doesn't harm the mushroom population. The vegetative mycelium is in the soil. Picking a flower isn't going to kill a plant, and collecting mushrooms is not going to kill the fungus. You may even be helping the morel population by inadvertently spreading the spores. I put links to more information on morels along with the text to this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 13th. The Boy Scouts of America was founded in 1910. A North Dakota Council was established in 1911. Boy Scout troops were quickly organized across the state. Many of these troops formed at churches in conjunction with Sunday schools, but they made it clear that boys didn't have to be church members to join. Local businessmen, educators, and prominent community members were quick to volunteer as leaders. Scouting appealed to boys and adults. Boys enjoyed being active and participating in positive activities. Adults felt confident the boys were learning valuable new skills and engaging in community service projects. In 1912, the first Boy Scout encampment in North Dakota took place in Valley City. It was clear the Boy Scouts were a big hit. The program continued over the years, and the boys weren't the only ones learning new skills. On this date in 1933, 40 Boy Scout leaders from North Dakota and eastern Montana gathered in Bismarck for a four-day regional camp leaders training course on the grounds of the state capitol. Gunnar Berg, the national director of volunteer training, came from New York City to lead the school. He was joined by members of the regional executive council. Among the participants were the executive of the Missouri Slope Area Council and the North Dakota Secretary of State. The men came prepared to sleep on the ground in tents and cook their own meals over open fires. The event kicked off with a hot dog roast. The program covered all aspects of camping, selecting a campground, setting up tents, building fires, and cooking meals. The program climaxed with a joint meeting of Bismarck's service clubs, where Berg was the featured speaker. He learned about the Scouts through his work as a teacher and school principal. For the past 5 years, he had served on the national staff, developing training programs. Today, there are an estimated 2,500 Boy Scouts in North Dakota. Scouting troops can be found in both urban and rural areas across the state. The Northern Lights Council serves all of North Dakota, plus parts of South Dakota, northwestern Minnesota, and northeastern Montana. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Ron Feierstein, author of A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, and a featured voice in the upcoming American Experience documentary, Mr. Polaroid. Feierstein helps us explore the rise, innovation, and legacy of Edwin Land, the visionary inventor who changed photography forever and inspired the likes of Steve Jobs, plus another Prairie Place with Dr. Eric Berg from NDSU. We'll talk grilling in what promises to be a tasty segment. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we invite you to join us again.